Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and I'm afraid it's just me introducing the podcast today. Hopefully you'll all be able to notice the slight improvement in audio quality as I've spent a bit of my pocket money on some new equipment for myself. It's the least I can do having spent so much time on the oil rigs lately. Anyway, I'm going to keep this short and sweet for the introduction today, but stick around and I'll go through a little housekeeping at the end of the interview. So recently I've had a chance to talk to Dr. Hanneke Meyer of the Catalan Institute of Paleontology in Barcelona. I first saw Hanneke's work doing the rounds on Twitter and thought it seemed too good of a story to miss. And not only are we talking about a very famous extinct animal, but also a very strange taphonomic process. So sit back, put your feet up and enjoy this discussion of the Mare Sauvage. So thanks very much for joining us, Hanneke. Can you give us an introduction to yourself and tell us how you became a paleontologist?
Well, I've always wanted to be a paleontologist when I was a little kid. Of course, I saw Jurassic Park and then I got sort of hooked. And I think most kids grow out of it at one point. Once they hit puberty, other things become more interesting. but I guess I kind of got stuck in that place, as I think many of my colleagues did as well. So I've always been interested in fossils. And during my university studies, I was able to do a research project as a student at the National Museum of Natural History in Leiden in the Netherlands. And I wanted to do a PhD in paleo as well, but those are a little hard to find. So I ended up with a PhD in a closely related field, anatomy, muscle anatomy specifically. But after my PhD, I was able to pick up my paleontological research again. And I've been in paleo ever since.
Okay, and you're a postdoc now, aren't you?
Yes, I'm a postdoctoral fellow. It's the official name, at the Catalan Institute for Paleontology in Barcelona.
And what's your project that you're doing there?
I've been very lucky to be able to continue my projects here in Barcelona. I was in D.C. in the United States before. That's where I started my first study of fossil birds from Southeast Asia. And I've been able to do that here as well. So I'm continuing and expanding my research here. And I'm looking at fossil birds from Southeast Asia and as well as their paleoecological implications and their implications for human evolution in that area as well.
And so why birds?
Why birds? Well, actually, I think that's more of a coincidence than an actual preconceived idea. I think when I was a student, I was looking at a private collection of fossils from someone who's been collecting for years and years. And these were mostly mammoths and reindeers and basically a very typical Ice Age fauna. And some of the bones actually were something that I didn't know what to do with. And I ended up figuring out what they were, and they turned out to be birds. And that's when I started to realize that there's not that many people working on birds. Therefore, would be very good to continue in that field and start to learn more about it. So it was basically more a coincidence than an actual thing that I wanted to follow for a long time.
So we're going to be talking about birds today, and in particular, some birds from the Mare Sauvage locality in Mauritius, isn't it? What does Mare Sauvage actually mean?
Mare Sauvage means the marsh of dreams or the sea of dreams. And it is a small marshy area in the southeastern part of Mauritius, which is an oceanic island east of Africa and even east of Madagascar. And it's a volcanic island, which means that a lot of the groundwater levels and the groundwater itself that we find on the island are acidic. But there's a few places on the island where there are small basins which have been filled in over time with organic matter that basically serves as a buffer against the acidic groundwater. And in those small basins, we find bones from extinct animals and even plant remains. And Mare Sauvage is one of those basins that contains these organic materials, and that's where we find dodos.
And how old is this locality?
We've dated some of the bones that we found in there, and it's about 4,200 years old. And this point in time coincides with a period of extreme drought on the island. So it was a very dry seasons, and there wasn't a lot of rain. And we think that this area attracted animals because they were in need of fresh water. There wasn't much fresh water on the island. So a lot of animals gathered around this area to drink. And we think that because of the soft sediments in this area, because it was a marshy area, many animals became trapped in the sands and eventually died.
Looking at the Mare Sange today, though, it's not the same depositional setting. It's been filled in, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. At the beginning of the 20th century, the risk of malaria became very pronounced. So the government decided to fill in the basins, and they basically fill it in with rocks and gravel, anything they could find. And that makes excavating a little difficult because the first meter and a half can consist of big chunks of rock and gravel that has to be taken out by a mechanical excavator. So yeah, that makes it a little bit more difficult. And after it was filled in, the nearby international airport was constructed, and the site itself was thought to be lost in that construction. So for decades, people didn't bother looking for the site again because they just assumed that it had been lost. But in 2005, my colleague Kenneth Rijsdijk was involved in a different archaeological excavation of a nearby Dutch fort, very early settlement. And he was looking for sites in the area to take cores for pollen and chemical analysis. And then he was walking through this area and decided to put some cores in. And then when he took the cores out, there were small pieces of bone in there. Now, Kenneth doesn't know anything about bones. So he ended up with me and my colleagues, and it was very clear that we had rediscovered the Mare Sange site. So that was very exciting.
So the fossils that you get there, were they known before the basin was filled in?
Yes. Yes. We know that dodos had been found in that site before. In the 1880s, there was a Mauritian school teacher, George Clark, who explored the site a number of times, and he did find a lot of dodo bones and tortoise bones and other animals in that basin. And he contacted George Owen, who was at the time a paleontologist in London, and he was the one to start describing the bones scientifically for the first time. But after the explorations of Clark and Owen, a number of other people excavated that site as well. And there's a lot of material today in museums worldwide that comes from the same area, comes from Mare Sange. But at the beginning of the 20th century, many people assumed that the site had been lost. And especially after the construction of the nearby airport, people more or less assumed that the site was gone and would never be found again.
So working in a marsh, is it pretty difficult because of all the water there? If you're trying to dig a hole, doesn't it just keep on filling up?
Yeah, it does. But being from Holland, we did what people from Holland do best, which is make polders. And that is basically what we did in Mare Sange. Not me, but my colleagues constructed this little dam around the site that we had an interest in and put inside a big pump to pump out the water and basically created a dry surface to excavate from. Well, this was the idea that they had initially, and unfortunately it didn't work perfectly in practice. Because at the end of our season, we had taken out so much sediment from the layers that there was the balance between the water coming up from below and the weight of the sediments on top was lost, and therefore we had a big eruption of water coming through from below And yeah, that was unforeseen.
It sounds pretty messy.
Yeah, we had to get out pretty quickly, and it destroyed some of our excavations. But it was very interesting to watch and to learn about the dynamics of such a geologically very interesting area.
So did it put a lot of constraints onto your actual field work in terms of the amount of time you could be there, the amount of money that you could spend?
Yes. Although I have to say that we had a lot of support from the sugarcane plantation that the site is located on. They were able to help us out many times with equipment and technological issues that we had. But Mauritius being an island, many of the special equipment that we needed had to be flown in. And of course, it also puts a limit on the amount of time you can spend there, because travel is time consuming, it's expensive. So we had to work very focused way to achieve what we wanted to achieve. And most of our field work, most of the actual excavating was done lying down on a platform just above the surface with the sound of the pump continuously going on to keep the water out. So it was interesting, definitely.
It definitely sounds like one of the hardest field work situations that I've heard of. So
yeah, it was, I mean, I've had excavations in Indonesia as well, where I suffered heat strokes and scorpions, but this was definitely very different, I have to say.
So it was obviously worth it. You managed to find dodos. So
yes, that made up for everything.
Can you tell us about these?
We found a lot of dodo remains. All of them were bones. We did not find any feathers or eggshells or soft tissue remains. But we did find a lot of dodo bones, as well as bones from giant tortoises, bats, and small birds. For me personally, it was very, very rewarding to see an actual dodo bone being excavated right before my eyes and being able to touch it and actually take it out of the ground. Nobody would have seen that bone until you were the one to excavate it yourself. So that was very special. So over 3 years, so that's three different field seasons, we excavated a total of 235 dodo bones and bone fragments. And of those, the majority were bones from the legs and feet. And at first we were very puzzled because we didn't really know how to explain that. Then we started looking at the geology of the site and at the fact that during the dry season, or during the time of deposition, it was a very dry period on Mauritius. And we started thinking about how animals would behave when fresh water would be very scarce. And even though Mauritius is a place with fresh water, even in times of low rain, low precipitation, the water would have been constricted to a very small part of the actual or the former lake. And therefore, the surrounding sediments would could still be moist, but animals had to walk across those soft sediments to get to the fresh water. And especially for heavy animals such as giant tortoises and large flightless birds, if you're walking across soft sediments, you'll sink into it. And if you're very unfortunate, you get stuck. Animals that would have gotten stuck like that and could have easily died, especially when they're already weakened by thirst and possibly lack of food. And when an animal dies like that, the upper part of the body would have been left exposed to the elements, whereas the lower part of the body would have been buried inside the soft sediments and would have been preserved, basically, whereas the upper part of the body would have been lost over time. And I think that's why we find so many bones of the feet and the legs, is that they just got preserved and the rest of the animal just rotted away or was blown away or over time was lost to the elements.
So there's a large proportion of foot bones in those 200 specimens, did you say there were?
Yes, yes. Almost 75% of the bones that we found were bones from the feet and the legs.
So how many individuals do you think you have?
Based on the number of unique bones that we found, we estimate that we found at least 17 individual dodos. And we base that on the fact that every animal only has one bone of each. So if you find 17 left femurs or left thigh bones, that means that you have at least 17 different individuals.
Right, okay.
But there were likely to be many more birds that died there because we only excavated a very small portion of the whole site. So we're now working towards estimating how many animals actually are in the whole Magosongi site by extrapolating our findings to the whole surface area, the whole content, the volume of the site.
Did you find any juvenile specimens, or have you not really got a large enough sample size?
The sample that we excavated in over these 3 years did not contain any juveniles. It is possible that our sample was too small, because there it seems like there were juvenile bones found there a century before. But it might also be the case that juveniles were not heavy enough to become stuck in the mud, or that it was the marshy area was only dangerous during certain parts of the year when it was very, very dry, and possibly outside the breeding season, or that juvenile dodos grew really fast and that they were they looked very mature at a very early age, so that we don't recognize them as being first year dodos.
You've mentioned that the deposit is just 4,000 years old, and so mm-hmm. are the remains actual fossils? Have they been turned to stone, or are they more like, I don't know, mummified or something?
No, they're not the heavy mineralized type of bones that we see from sites that are 1 million, 2 million, or even 60 million years old. The bones are still very much actual bone. They have not been mineralized at all. They do show certain signs of preservation. They have a different coloring on the surface. They're dark and sometimes even have little etchings on the side. And the articular surfaces on both ends of the bones show erosion and damage that is testament to the fact that they've been down inside the sediments for a long time. But we refer to them as fossils because we took them out of the ground, and then, yeah, it's easy to refer to them as fossils. I think technically they are subfossils, but we've always referred to them as fossils.
During the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology that PaleoCast covered last year, I spoke to a girl who'd been looking at invertebrate damage to some of the fossil bones at Rancho La Brea, the tar pits. Mm-hmm. And those had been aerially exposed for a small period of time, enough for small insects to have laid their eggs on them and to have eaten them. Is there any damage you can see to these bones, or are they generally in a good condition?
They are generally in a good condition, although it's very possible that they were exposed or aerially exposed for short periods of time in the past. The study that I published is only a very preliminary study, and we're hoping to go into more detail on things like micro-erosion on the surface and things like that in the future. And also, there seem to be signs of chemical erosion, especially from plant roots that go down into the soil and secrete chemicals that affect the surface of the bone. And we're hoping to look at these things in the future. And be able to tell more about how these bones, what the conditions were of these bones and how they were preserved over time.
I like eating chicken and I have never eaten the feet of one. I know some people do, but it's not to my taste, especially if they were to be covered in mud. Could it be possible that they've been eaten? The top half of the dodo has been eaten by a predator and left the bottom half. Do we have any evidence for any other animals in the area? Do we get any other fossils?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. The thing with oceanic islands, especially the ones that are as isolated as Mauritius, is that they generally lack mammalian carnivores. So therefore, things like wolves, dogs, hyenas, cats, anything that's big and furry and eats other animals is generally lacking on islands. So I think we can reject the hypothesis that they were eaten by a typical carnivore. However, animals like tortoises and also sometimes bats can feed on animal tissue sometimes, especially when they're very hungry and other resources are very scarce. They sometimes turn to other animals to eat. It would be a very good study if we could find signs of that. We haven't found any indication that it actually happened, but it would be very good to look at the signs that turtles, or the traces that turtles leave on bones when they're actually eating the flesh of it. As far as I know, there's no study that describes these traces, so it would be very good to feed, for instance, chickens to hungry tortoises and see what they do with it. I think that would be a very cool experiment. There's also the question that people ask, what did people eat them? Did people eat dodos? But I think that is a very different question, because it's not, people didn't come to Mauritius until 1510, I think. So it wasn't an issue at this point of time, especially not when the Marisons was formed.
Are the other animals that you get there, are they just as important as the dodos? Do you have people researching the tortoises and bats and birds?
We don't have as many people as we would like to have. I think there's always the question that there's so many more research questions than we have the resources to answer. People did look at the giant tortoise remains, but there's a whole bunch of other animals as well that we really need to study, especially the smaller bird bones and the bat bones, for instance. Gillian Hume, who's a paleontologist from the UK, has done a lot of work on the paleontology of these other animals. So he's one of the few people that actually does look at the other animals that were there. But yeah, we definitely could meet more people like him.
So if we have a look at the Mara Sange as a whole, what was it like 4,000 years ago? I know you said that there's been a dry period. We've got dodos, tortoises, bats, and other birds. Would it otherwise have just looked like Mauritius today?
The sad thing is that Mauritius suffered a lot of habitat destruction over time. I think by now only 2% of the original forest cover remains. So it's not as easy to reconstruct the Mauritius of 4,000 years ago by looking at Mauritius of today. We do know from paleobotanical work, which people looking at the remains of plants and flowers, is that there were a lot of trees around Mara Sange. And Gillian Hume actually made really nice reconstructions of this, of how Mara Sange looked back in the day. And it shows you that it was a very diverse habitat with lots of different plants and trees, a lot of birds around, as well as bats and even insects. So, but we're still just starting to piece together what Mauritius looked like 4,200 years ago. And we're using information from a lot of different resources, not just the bones, but also there are people working on the pollen records from Mauritius and the plant remains. So that is something that I think will continue into the next years, definitely.
So looking at the dodo itself, it's perhaps the most famous extinct animal of them all. But what was it like when it was alive?
The interesting thing about the dodo is that there seems to be a lot of information about it out and about. But if you actually look at the sources, it has all been repeated from the same sources over and over again. So in the end, we only have a few accurate accounts of what the dodo looked like and behaved like. And we're not even sure what it ate. For the longest time, people thought that it was eating this large seed-like fruits from a tree on Mauritius called the tambalakok. And it was for a long time, people thought that that tree actually needed the dodo in order to germinate the seeds, because it would pass through the intestinal tract of the dodo, and then afterwards it could, it was the only way for it to germinate. But that turned out to be not like that. It was actually because the trees are still there, but the dodo is extinct. So that's an interesting fact, given that supposedly the tree needed the dodo to survive. So many of these stories that we think we know actually are not as accurate as we like them to be. So therefore, looking at the bones and trying to reconstruct the behavior and the ecology of this species becomes more important as we're trying to reconstruct what happened to it and how this whole ecosystem came to be, and also why it is disappearing at the moment.
So how's our image changed of the dodo over time? In my head, I don't know if this is the stereotypical view, but it's a pretty short, fat, ugly looking thing.
Yeah, I think that is the general view. And I don't think that the general view will change all that much. But people always think of the dodo as a stupid, fat bird that couldn't do much and was bound to become extinct. However, in the view of island ecology, dodos were perfectly adapted to their surroundings. So that means that they were doing very well for themselves. They were not just stupid little birds. And especially, they were doing just fine until people came along. And of course, that's when things usually go downhill.
Yeah, so what was it that caused their extinction? Was it just greedy Dutch sailors?
That also seems to be the general assumption. But I can tell you that is not true. There has not been much evidence for people actually eating or overeating dodos. I do think that people ate dodos while they were there, but I don't think the population of people on Mauritius was big enough to impact the dodo into extinction. Much more likely is it that dodos eventually fell victim to all the exotic animals that came with humans. People brought, for instance, macaques that they kept as pets on the boats. They introduced deer to the island, pigs. There were dogs, there were cats, and there were rats. And especially rats seem to be very vicious, especially for birds that nest on the ground and can't fly. So I think taken together, that whole suite of non-native animals had a far bigger impact on the population of dodos than the few humans that every now and then had a dodo barbecue.
So what have your new specimens added to our understanding of this bird?
Well, the research that I wrote about is gives the first hypothesis of how the Marosonge dodo mass grave came to be, why all these animals died at this particular spot. And it also provides us with a baseline for the ecosystem on Mauritius before modern human arrival. And if we want to understand how the whole Mauritius ecosystem, not just the dodo, but how the whole ecosystem is affected by human population overhunting and impact of non-native species, then we need to look at what it was like before all these species and humans came on the island. So this is just a start, hopefully, of a longer study of the dodo, and actually we hope to continue excavating in the future again, and that way we can keep adding more information to all the dodo information that's already out there, and eventually, who knows, maybe even resurrect the dodo.
I don't think,
although that might be science fiction, but we'll
I don't
never know.
Think that the dodo park would have quite the appeal of Jurassic Park. But I'd still go. I don't think it'd be that much of a problem if the electric fences went down. I don't think Jeff Goldblum would have quite such a bad time of it.
No, that's a good one. No, but my work mainly focused on how dodo birds and other animals became trapped in this area. And we're now continuing our work into specifically looking at the bones themselves. What does it tell us about dodo anatomy and dodo physique in general? And how can we apply that to all the knowledge that we already have? How does that add to that? So we're hoping to continue our research in the next few years.
Well, Hanneke, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, I hope you've all enjoyed the interview. If so, please help us spread the show to all those who might not yet have heard of it. Rating us on iTunes really does mean a lot in terms of getting the show noticed, and so it would be greatly appreciated. If you want to discuss this episode further, we've got the comments section on the post over at paleocast.com, and then we've got our Facebook page, Twitter account, and forum. This is also where you can get in touch with the show regarding interviews that you'd like to hear or subjects that you'd like covering. We've already taken a few requests and have already arranged interviews for them. We've also had a request on Twitter to share a little more information on our download statistics. So at time of recording, we've reached just under 35,000 downloads, and that's really from all corners of the globe. We've had 42% from the USA, 26% from the UK, 9 from Australia and 8 from Canada, and that's 15 shared between 92 other countries. And a special mention should go to Germany for being the highest number of downloads from a non-English speaking country. Looking regionally, our highest downloads in ascending order are from Alberta, New York, Pennsylvania, Victoria, Texas, New South Wales, London, Ontario, and topping them all off with twice the downloads of any of those mentioned is California. So a big shout out to all those using your favourite colloquialism. The download stats are really something that surprised me every time I take a look at them, so thanks for your continued support. We're still getting increasing numbers of downloads despite us not having released anything for over a month. And that's not anything to do with our laziness. Three of the group have PhDs to be battling with and I'm working a lot. But the podcast isn't the only thing we've been producing. We've also been busy on our Facebook and Twitter sites, where each weekday we've been delivering our lunchtime lectures from December's Paleontological Association meeting in Zurich, Switzerland. We've got plenty more of those to come too, so if you missed that event and want to catch up on any of the presentations, that's a brilliant place to start. So stay tuned for those as they're released over the coming weeks. And if you've missed any, they're all being collated on paleocast.com and you can find it under the live tab. Well, that's all from me today, so I hope you've enjoyed listening and I'll see you all next time.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soul. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.